an interesting talk, I think, and I would offer up that I would like this to be the start of a conversation. So what I'm going to say to you, you may agree with, you may disagree with. That's okay. But what we need to do, I think, is to talk about it and have it as something that we challenge each other about. And part of that is challenging ourselves. So one of my challenges to myself was the first title. Originally, I had put... Where should I stand for feedback? Yeah. Originally, I had put, what is a refugee? Now, I'll let you think about why that's not the right thing to put. What's wrong with what is a refugee? It makes them an object. It makes a person into a thing. And we'll talk about this as we go through. So having done some research and looking at some websites, I realised that that is the right way to put it. Who is a refugee? Because we're talking about people and not things. So just some thoughts then, who is a refugee? Any thoughts on what, how we define that status?
Somebody who's left their home.
Somebody's left their home, yes.
By force. By force or economic
By
reasons.
Force, yes.
Seeking refuge.
Seeking refuge, yes. Any others? So the definition I've found is a refugee is someone who has been forced, thank you Paul, to flee his or her country because of persecution, war, or violence. A refugee has a well-founded fear of persecution for reasons of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. Most likely, they cannot return home or are afraid to do so. War and ethnic, tribal, and religious violence are leading causes of refugees fleeing their homes. So if we could have the next slide, you may not be able to read this, but it doesn't come out too badly. So this is from the UNHCR, just to give you a bit of background on some statistics, which is always a good place to start. So around the world, there are 68.5 million people who have been forcibly displaced, so are no longer in their homes. Of those, 40 million are still in their own country and therefore are not refugees because they are within their own country, but they've been forcibly displaced from their homes within that country. Of those, 25.5 million people are refugees because they have left their country to go to another country to seek that refuge. 25.5, and of those, 3.1 million are seeking asylum somewhere in the world. Now, I'm not going to make this a political talk, but if I'm going to make one very minor political point, it'll be about the diagram on the right. And it'll be about the countries that are hosting and how many people they are hosting. So the country that's hosting the most refugees in the world is Turkey, with 3.5 million people. The one I wanted to pick out was Lebanon. Lebanon is hosting 1 million people as refugees. The population of Lebanon is 6 million. So they have taken on board, I don't know what the percentage is, the math teachers will tell me, it's probably about 15%, 15, 16% extra people into their country. So when we are having conversations in this country about how many people we can and should and are able to take on board, I'd just ask you to remember some of those stats, particularly some of the poorer countries in the world are hosting some of the most numbers of refugees. The figure in the middle, 102,800, almost 103,000, is quite an interesting figure when you compare it to either 25.5 million or 3.1 million, but that's the number of refugees who have been resettled. So they've actually made a new home in a new place. Which is, you know, it's a fraction, isn't it? It's 1%, it's a tiny percentage. And then the last one I'll pick out, the countries. So the countries where most of the biggest sources of people leaving their home, seeking refuge, 57% are from these three locations. Syria, 6.3 million people have left Syria to seek refuge elsewhere. Afghanistan, 2.6 million, and South Sudan. So again, not to take any political side in this, but to understand the size and shape of the decisions that we make as a country as to where we do or don't intervene. And I'm not saying either one of those is right, but those conflicts can have huge effects. And some of them are terribly complicated, so I'm not suggesting we should intervene, but those three countries have created the biggest shift of people out of those numbers. So I think that's quite sobering, is it not? Just the numbers. And this is not stuff we'll see every day. This is not stuff we'll be aware of every day. We'll hear about the odd stories, but this is the scale of what we're talking about. So if we could move on. Thank you. So, what is God's view of refugees? And I'm going to use turn to Deuteronomy for this. So if you'd like to, if you've got your Bibles and if you want to, if you go back to page 194, and it's Deuteronomy 15, verse 7 to 11. So if anyone is poor among your fellow Israelites in any of the towns of the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and this is what I particularly like in this, version of the Bible, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted. It's tremendously descriptive, isn't it? You can see it. You know, there's my fist, I've got it, I've got my money in my hand, and I'm not letting go. It's very, very descriptive. Rather, be open-handed and freely lend them whatever they need. Now, there's 2 points here. Firstly, we didn't read the verses before, but the preceding verses are about... Verse 4 says, however, there need be no poor people among you, for in the Lord your God, for in the land your Lord is giving you to possess as your inheritance, he will richly bless you. So we had some prayers earlier about how glorious this creation is. And one of my points is, and if you look at wealth figures and food production figures, there is no doubt that there is far more available in the world than the whole world needs to survive. It's without doubt. We are far more fruitful and productive than we need to be to provide for the basic needs of every single person in this world. However, it's how that gets shared and distributed which is the challenge. So God is saying, look, I gave you everything you need. There shouldn't be anyone who's poor. However, there will be, because human beings being what they are and God speaking through noses, I know that people can act selfishly and won't follow the statutes, will get themselves into trouble, therefore there will always be, and we'll come to that, but there will always be poor. The other point I want to pick out, that I'll probably pick up later, will be lend them whatever they need. So this isn't necessarily about, you know, if someone just needs a sandwich, giving them £1 million. It's about providing for people at the point of their need, and providing for their needs in that place and that location and that time. And that may be something massive and huge, or it may be something small. The one thing I'm absolutely convinced of, whatever it is, when it's us that God is calling us to respond in that way, it will be something that we are fully able to provide and give, because God wouldn't have called us to do that if it wasn't. So do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted towards them. Rather, be open-handed and freely lend them whatever they need. Be careful not to harbour this wicked thought. The seventh year, the year for cancelling debts, is near, so that you do not show ill will towards the needy. So this is, remember, in Deuteronomy, Moses is handing out a whole series of laws to the people of Israel about how they should live, how they should behave. And God being what God is, God knows that they're going to need these laws to help them to direct their thinking. Now, the whole kind of thrust of this whole book, really, is about... It's not really about the law. The law is there to help, but the challenge is not to live according to the letter of the law, but to live according to the spirit of the law, and to act in a way where it's a heartfelt response, not a, I've got the legal ticket that tells me what I can or cannot do. So the point here is there's a law around cancelling debts in the seventh year. There's some debate about whether that was complete cancellation of debts or whether it was a cancellation of payments for that year. But either way, it was a relief in the seventh year for people of what they owed. So if I owed anybody money in that seventh year, I wouldn't have to pay that money back. And then in the 50th year, there's a jubilee, which is a cancellation of all debts that you owe to anyone. But what God is saying through Moses is, don't use that to your advantage. Don't say to yourself, well, it's all right, it's okay, because next year, in a few months' time or a year's time, those debts will be cancelled, so I don't have to help them because they'll be all right, because you know, we're close to the seventh year, it'll be all right, they'll be okay. So that you do not show ill will towards the needy among your fellow Israelites. Give generously to them, do so without a grudging heart. Then because of this, the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in everything you put your hand to. There will always be poor people in the land. Therefore, I command you to be open-handed towards your fellow Israelites who are poor and needy in your land. And this is something Jesus says to us, doesn't it? He says in one of the Gospels, he says, the poor will always be with you. When the alabaster jar is being broken, I've forgotten, is it Mary Magdalene? And she's pouring out the really expensive perfume, and Judah wants to take it and sell it. And he says, doesn't he, because I want to spend it on the poor. But we suspect that that's not really what he wanted. That's not what his heart was about. He wanted the money, so he had control of the money to do with it what he wanted. Not about a free expression of love and giving. So this is really all about having a heart. God has given us everything that we need to live abundantly, the whole of the human race. And he's calling us individually to respond in a heart sense to people who we meet who have need. And to have sympathy, but not really sympathy, it's about empathy for where they are, and to meet them at their point of need with what they need. Because God is willing to give us everything that we need, not only for us, but for those people that we meet and we want to reach out to. Melvin, go to the next slide. Sorry, I should have a clicker, shouldn't I? So why do we struggle with the reality of refugees? Well, I think the first thing is what we spoke about at the start. It's a huge challenge. So some of the prayers and some of the things that have been said this morning, what do I do individually about something that's so big that I'm not sure that I can cope with it? And so we turn it into a problem. We call it the refugee crisis. But if we call it a crisis, then we've made it a problem. If we've made it a problem, we've made it a thing. If we've made it a thing has a problem, has component parts. We call those components refugees. And now, because neatly in my brain I've managed to put it in a box, I can cope with it now because I can stick it on the shelf and I can say, I'll look at that later. I'll worry about that another day. So I want to talk to you a little bit about the brain. So I've been doing some reading about this. It's quite interesting. But it speaks to our challenge. So there's something very interesting about the way the brain works. Our brains are probably the most powerful computer that exists, right? So they are incredibly, incredibly powerful. They are also amazingly lazy. So if you've ever driven to work and you've not remembered the journey into work, had that experience? Yeah, lots of, right, okay. That's because what happens is your brain brings on board a whole load of experiences, and while you're driving to work, it's checking those. The only thing it wants to do is wake you up from whatever you're doing, planning, you know, Sunday lunch or holiday or whatever, if there's something that's so far outside of its expectations that it doesn't know what to do with it. So when you arrive at work and say, I've no idea how I got here, I don't remember that journey, it's because the brain is going to all those times you've driven in the past and going, no, it's okay, I recognise this, I know this roundabout. People are usually okay at the roundabout, there's no traffic. It's figuring all that, without you thinking about it cognitively, it's doing all that stuff. And so you get to where, I don't remember that. The only times you'll remember a journey is when you've had some particularly nasty disruption, or there's been an accident, something that's so far out of that normal range of operation that your brain currently goes, I've got to wake you up now because I don't know what to do with it, I've never met it before, I've got to switch the thinking circuits on. Now, that happens in everything that we do. And I am going to tie it back. And the reason I say it is because that happens when we think about things like the refugee crisis, or refugees, or when we think about people who are homeless, or anything else that we might find challenging. The brain does an awful lot of stuff automatically. And it does that outwardly as well as inwardly. So we receive opinions and views. And we receive values from other people. And we do it almost unquestioningly. And I'm going to run a little thought experiment with you in a minute to demonstrate this. But the danger is we adopt views and opinions from other people without questioning and without challenging them. And so when we're talking about refugees, everyone in this room will have a view and an opinion about what a refugee is and how we respond to it. And some of those may be ones you've thought about specifically. Some of them you may have got from the media, from parents, from friends, from social media, and you might not have challenged them. So I'm going to do a little experiment. Bear with me. I'm going to draw a line. And the line is going to run down the middle of this aisle. And on this side, I'm going to call you the residents. Have a line down the middle. And on this side, I'm going to call you the refugees. I'd like you to sit with that just for a minute and have a chat with your neighbour just for a quick minute about how that makes you feel. You're the residents. This is your land, your place. You are refugees. You've left your homes. You have no place, no status, no home, no schools. How does that feel? What does it bring up into your minds? Have a quick chat with each other about what that makes you think or feel. Right, I'm just going to call you back together. That was a quick minute, sorry. So I'm going to start with this side, the people who are the refugees. What were your thoughts? What came to mind? Going to panic overdrive. Interesting. I know. And so there's a panic there. There's a fear. Suddenly I don't know where I stand. How are these people going to respond to me? What am I going to do? Okay, thank you. Any other thoughts? Interesting. You get in the boat with hope, you get out of it the other end with fear. Interesting. Right. You've got this vision, and then reality strikes. Yeah. Very vulnerable. Yeah, interesting. Sorry. Yeah, don't speak the language. Isolated. Envious, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Because they've got something we don't have. Yeah. Okay, thank you. So residents, how are you feeling? Very fine line, that's interesting. Yes, thank you. Yeah. Yes. Okay, good. Like, uncomfortable in your, in the comfort that you now you've got a comparison. Yes. So to leave all of that behind, has to be so serious. Yeah, thank you. Rob?
Safe, but not knowing what effect they might have on my safety.
Yes. So there's a bit of fear this side as well. Suddenly there's these people here that's a great big body. How are they going to affect my life? Yeah? Okay, slightly responsible. Yes.
We've got plenty of room over here. Yeah. We want to share some of our room with them. They can come over to us. We've got plenty of room. Yeah.
Thank you. They've got plenty of room. Thank you.
Can I say something from a refugee point? Yes. Plus, I was a refugee when age 7. We had to get out of Burma because of the political situation. And there's two things I remember. One was that, as a family, my parents obviously were feeling very displaced, very different, and also had other relatives. And they did try and recreate as much as they could of what would come, particularly with food.
Yeah.
And for me personally, I found that at school, and with other kids, I went out of my way to come poor.
Right.
So I became quick.
So there's that kind of trying to recreate that sense of home, and we hear those stories, don't we? If you listen to the news, people who do try to recreate that sense of home in their new place in order to maintain that stability. So I think that's really interesting, and the reactions you've had, and I wanted to do that partly because just imagine, just see what's happened. That line in the middle here does not exist, right? It's completely imaginary. And yet, the brain is so powerful that what we perceive to be reality feels exactly the same as real reality. Now, bear that in mind then, as we're talking more about this, because that should affect how we, if when we approach people, remember, we all approach people with that whole set of stuff going on in our brains in the background. And what I would like to ask all of us to do this morning is challenge our own thinking. One of my favourite Roald Dahl books is The BFG. If you've read it, he catches dreams in a net and he sticks them in jars, right? Paul tells us to make every thought captive. My challenge to all of us this morning is when we're thinking about other people, especially if they're negative or they're a bit, ain't it awful kind of thoughts, I'd like you to catch that thought with a net, stick it in a jar, put a top on it, and have a look at it. Where did that thought come from? Where did I get it from? Was it in the news? Was it a political statement? Was it friends and family? Because we can agree with those really easily, and actually that can be quite pernicious if we don't capture it and challenge it. So, next slide, please. So, how are we called to respond? And I'm going to go to the Galatians for this. So, do have a look. It's 1172, and I'm going to read you a bit from the Message, because the Message puts this really nicely as well. But just in terms of how we are called to respond, I chose this reading because, remember back to the Deuteronomy, that's about calling us to respond with our heart, not simply to apply the letter of the law. And so this reading is really about responding in the Spirit. It's all about, so I say, live by the Spirit. This is verse 16. And you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. For the flesh desires what is contrary to the Spirit, and the Spirit what is contrary to the flesh. They are in conflict with each other, so that you are not to do whatever you want, but if you are led by the Spirit, you're not under the law. So this is about not trying desperately to meet the requirements of all those laws. It's about responding in the moment, at the moment, to whatever we feel is in front of us and we are called to respond to, whatever that may be. Whether it be to do with the refugee challenge or a refugee we see or a homeless person, whatever it is, it's about getting close to God and letting God move us by the Spirit. And the challenge with that is that it doesn't always make sense. In fact, quite a lot of time, it doesn't make sense. That's how God challenges us. This thing about our brains and these things that we want to do, the challenge to that is we have, a set playbook. This is what I always do, and I do it this way. But then if God intervenes and says, no, I don't want you to do that, I want you to go a different way, that hurts. That's change. That's difficult. That's not easy. But that is God calling us to think differently, to do differently, because God knows what impact that's going to have. Now, us approaching those, you know, if it's a person we're talking to, we're going to have all that stuff we spoke about. We're going to have fear. We're going to have preconceived notions. One of my concerns about removing the line down the middle is that what we've all just automatically done, without even thinking about it, is put the line that sits around the outside of us back in place. My worry is that without thinking about it, there's a line that sits outside of us that says, we're in here, and they're out there. Whoever we perceive they to be, they're out there. What God wants for us to do is to work inwardly, have the Spirit work inwardly within us so that we can work outwardly in the world, so that we can break down those barriers, so that we can cross those divides. You'll remember when Princess Diana, I think she hugged someone who had AIDS. She was in physical contact with someone who had AIDS. That enormously changed the whole perception of that disease. One act. One simple act. And so one of the things I want to say is that however fearful we might be about what God is calling us to do and how challenging it is, what we have no idea about is the onward impact of that. So whether it be supporting someone who's in a refugee situation, whether it be working with Paul on the Hope into Action House, we're doing one thing in one place at one time, but God will take that and bless it and multiply it and make it so it reaches lots of other people. I think one of my concerns and one of my challenges to us, we've been talking about the new church building that we want to build. I'd like us to be really clear. That church building isn't, I'm going to put this bluntly and then I'll qualify it, but that church building isn't for us. Okay? It is, but it's not for us to make us feel happy and have a good time and get in there and shut the doors and have fantastic worship space and really good worship and then go home again. That church is about reaching out to the world. And I'll tell you, the problem is not a financial problem. There is more than enough money in the world with enough connections to make the money available for that church the moment we are ready. And this is kind of reflecting on Melvin's message last week about Living Stones. That church will be ready for us when we, as a community, are ready for it. And that means working inwardly, challenging ourselves to live more closely by the Spirit, as it says here. The cause of division in the world is essentially, it puts it here, selfishness. You know, if we take for verse 14, for the entire law is fulfilled in keeping this one command, love your neighbour as yourself. And I did wonder about having the whole reading, because some of this stuff is quite challenging. The bits that are selfish, the acts of the flesh are obvious, sexual immorality, impurity and debauchery, idolatry and witchcraft, hatred, discord, jealousy, fits of rage, selfish ambition. I'm just going to read you this quickly from the message because I think it brings it a little bit more up to date and perhaps makes it a bit more accessible. It is obvious what kind of life develops after trying to get your own way all the time. Repetitive, loveless, cheap sex, a stinking accumulation of mental and emotional garbage, frenzied and joyless grabs for happiness, trinket gods, magic show religion, paranoid loneliness, cutthroat competition, all-consuming yet never satisfied wants, a brutal temper, an impotence to love or be loved, divided homes and divided lives, small-minded and lopsided pursuits, the vicious habit of depersonalizing everyone into a rival, uncontrolled and uncontrollable addictions, ugly parodies of community. I could go on. These are things that come from us acting selfishly. And what God is challenging us to do is to sacrifice that selfishness, to give it over to Him, and to let His Spirit fill our lives in everything. Now, I'm not suggesting any of us are involved in anything to that extent that's in there, but we all do things that are selfish. And what we have to do increasingly and more is to live in the Spirit and respond in the Spirit to challenge our own selfish nature of, I don't want to, or I haven't got enough, Whatever God is calling us to do, we absolutely have the provision to provide to others. And it's about meeting people at their need. So what can we do? What is our role? Well, that's for us each to respond. Our role is to respond at the point at which God calls us, and where and when and how. And that may be something local in Wellingborough. It may be, and I love Jackie's story about the boxes, and that there's, what was it, 10 million, Jackie? 10 million that's gone out. You know, look at the impact of something like that. So one small, if we're one small part of that, that all adds up. So where is God calling us? It may be that we have a heart for these things. I've been part of churches that sent way back when in Eastern Europe there with Romania, I think it was, with the orphanages. And they set a whole truckload of supplies and they drove them over. There are things that can be done. But maybe there's something that you're really passionate about that we don't know about yet. Maybe there's something that you feel we as a church need to be doing, ought to be doing, that we've not put on the agenda yet. Come and talk about it. Let's challenge each other to respond. In some ways, there's nothing we can do. But in some ways, and that's because sometimes we try and do this in our own strength. The thing we can do that will be effective is responding in the Spirit, to the Spirit, by the Spirit of God, because God knows what he wants us to do in this situation. It may be contributing to, I don't know, UNICEF or UNHCR or one of these organisations, one of these charities. It might not be. It might be something more close to home. So we talked about who a refugee is. Talk about some of the stats. And I'm absolutely convinced that those numbers will continue to go up. One of the points I didn't bring out, 44,000 people, I think it was every day or every week, are being displaced. So it's not going to go back. It's going to continue, I think. We talked about God's view of what he wants us to do, to not have a tight fist and a hard heart, but to have open hands and to respond to people's need. We talked about what challenges us, and that's our perceptions, I think, how we view and how we respond. And what can we do? We need to respond in the Spirit, by the Spirit. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things there is no law. Those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. Since we live by the Spirit, let us keep in step with the Spirit. Let us not become conceited, provoking and envying each other. And if we do that, then I believe that God will work miracles in our lives, work miracles in our community, and he will empower us to go out into the world to demonstrate God's love. Because if we do that for any one of these people that we see on the screen or that are close to us, then they will know what God has for them through us. In Jesus' name. Amen.